couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Charlie's Angels, The Warrior Queen of Jhansi, The Report, Waves, Ford vs. Ferrari, and The Good Liar. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Spirited Away. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news I wanted to talk about is about the film Black Christmas, which is a remake. It's the second remake of the 1974 horror slasher film from Bob Clark, the guy who also did A Christmas Story, believe it or not. But Black Christmas is getting its second remake. It's coming out on December the 13th, so it's Friday the 13th. And it looks like it's going to be a little bit of a deconstruction of the slasher genre, where the victims can kind of turn the table on the killer. And we've seen this sort of thing best done in a movie like You're Next. That was not very well received in theaters. A lot of horror fans saw it. But outside into the mainstream just didn't get that sort of turning the tables on the killers. And it got very violent in a Home Alone sort of way. And it looks like Black Christmas is going to be doing the same thing. The news came out this week that Black Christmas is in fact getting a PG-13 rating. Now, according to the internet, and we all know that the internet is infallible in its information and decisions, but according to the internet, Black Christmas was originally written to be an R-rated film. And if you know anything about the original from the 70s, and especially the remake, these were very violent, graphic horror movies. Now, of course, you watch the 1974 version of Black Christmas, and it's kind of tame now. But I mean, for 1974, I mean, this predates Halloween and Friday the 13th as a slasher film. Now, it was written by a woman named April Wolf, and she had come to Twitter to explain what had happened. So apparently they had written this to be an R-rated movie, and they had shot it. And during the test screening process, it turns out that they decided to go a PG-13 route. Now, first of all, this is nothing new for Blumhouse, the producer who's done this. Now, while Blumhouse has done a lot of great R-rated horror movies, and they've made a lot of money doing essentially teen slasher type movies, a great example would be Happy Death Day to You, which was a knockoff on the teen slasher, but that one was a PG-13 movie. And I love the Happy Death Day movies. But I'll be the first to point out that Blumhouse has no qualms about releasing a PG-13 horror film. The problem with PG-13 horror is they're very sanitized, and they don't have lasting power. I mean, remember that movie Truth or Dare? I think that actually came out this year, and it's already forgotten. And look, a lot of horror movies come and go, and you can find the 80s it's a minefield of slasher movies and horror movies that nobody's heard of. I mean, we're not talking about the Halloween sequels and that. I mean, we're talking about, like, you know, obscure horror movies that people generally don't remember unless you're like a big fan of 80s slashers. So this might be in that realm. The problem is I have no problem with somebody making a movie and saying, hey, let your chips fall where they may, and they end up getting like a softer rating than they expect, or they get a harder rating than they expect. Everyone in horror knows the story that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, they shot that so it would be shown on TV. They shot it for essentially a PG rating, and it got R. And it's a grisly horror movie because so much stuff happens off screen, and your mind takes care of that. And then you have essentially horror movies like Jaws, which was rated PG, although the PG-13 rating didn't exist back then, and it certainly would have been rated PG-13. In fact, I think it would have been rated R if it were rated by today's rating board. And April Wolf came out on Twitter and was saying, oh, well, it's because we needed to make it more accessible to a younger audience. And I'm like, really? That is now you just towing the corporate line. That is you recognizing that You have a very narrow market of women when they're under 20, and if they can get in at 17, you got basically 3 years for the girls. And there's also ignoring the fact that horror movies should be beloved and embraced by both sides. And heck, I mean, Halloween is a classic, and even the first Friday the 13th, more than anything else, is a classic girl power type of movie. So this is being handled with kids' gloves in the horror community because nobody wants to say that this was gender politics at work. And if you can look at anything, movies that are made for gender political reasons, like Terminator Dark Fate or like the Maleficent sequel, they tend not to do well if that's the reason they're made that way. It just make a movie. Just make a decent movie. Don't try and put too much gender politics in it or any kind of politics in it. Just make a movie that works. And I'm afraid that this curving the rating to a PG-13 rating is them meddling with it because they're trying to do social manipulation rather than just tell a good, solid, scary movie. And that's where I have issues with this movie. That is the only piece of news I have time for, but now it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is Sonic the Hedgehog, which opens on February 14th.
I'm Sonic, a little ball of super energy in an extremely handsome package. On my planet, people were always after my powers. So I came to yours.
Why are you hiding out in my garage?
They're coming for me! If they steal my power, they could conquer the universe. You have to help me.
No, I don't.
Please, it's life or death.
Whatever this creature is, I'm going to uncover the source of its power.
Yeah, hey.
This is the second trailer that dropped, and famously, this new trailer has the redesigned Sonic character in it. If you recall, when they dropped the first trailer, Sonic looked a little goofy. Sonic looked like it was falling into that uncanny valley. They made it less of a cartoon and more of a human-like, as it certainly doesn't look anything at all like a hedgehog. Sonic never has looked like a hedgehog, for that matter. But the version of Sonic looked really creepy. And fans and movie buffs and people who watch the trailer complained about it. And, you know, good on them for saying, hey, look, they had a point. Sonic looks goofy and weird, and it's going to be off-putting. It's sort of like the Grinch, the design of the Grinch in the Jim Carrey version doesn't really look like the Grinch, and the Whos don't look like Who, and they just look like it's just an entire two-hour movie of nightmare fuel. And the fact that they went back and redesigned Sonic makes it a little more palatable. It still looks like a movie that's cut from the same cloth as something like the Rocky and Bullwinkle movie they made in the late 90s. So I still don't know whether this is going to be any good, but at least Sonic looks better. The next one I want to hit really quickly is Fantasy Island, which also opens on February 14th.
Good evening. I'm Mr. Rurik. Let me officially welcome you to Fantasy Island.
So, what's your fantasy?
Revenge on a childhood bully.
Just want it. I see it.
Your life is about to change.
I got it. Yeah, I want it.
There is only one fantasy per guest. And you must see your fantasy through. No matter what.
Rourke, this is not what I meant.
People die here.
Again, this is from our friends at Blumhouse. And while I have a lot of respect for some of the things Blumhouse does, I am having a little bit of a problem with this movie because I used to watch Fantasy Island in the 70s and into the 80s. And I thought it was a great show and it was fun. It had some really neat supernatural elements to it. Now, granted, it was basically a fantasy version of The Love Boat where people went and they learned something and you had multiple stories. It was made by the same people who did The Love Boat. So you had those guest stars every week. This looks like it's trying to then make a horror movie out of it. And mark my words, Fantasy Island was never really a horror movie. Now, when they did the reboot back in the late 90s with Meechan and Mick and Malcolm McDowell, they tried to make it a little more sinister. But this one, it almost feels like they're just using it in name only, and they're really not making it an authentic Fantasy Island movie. And if you want to do that, then make it, you know, Wish Upon an Island or something like that. Why do you have to take the name Fantasy Island and then ruin it? There is a way out of this, and I hope they take it. But I'm a little skeptical on this just from the setup. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Waves and the Warrior Queen of Jhansi. and welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the waves with Waves. A family in suburban Florida suffers terrible personal losses when their son's high school career comes crashing down around
him. It's been hard. How you doing with everything?
I'm good.
Just a sweet word.
You know it's okay if you're not.
The table is prepared for you.
I'm trying to give you the tools to succeed in this world. It's not easy out there. Everything I do is for you. Everything.
I know you're under a lot of pressure right now, but I'm just getting really scared.
Everything's gonna be okay, all right?
Always.
We're in this together.
Now, right now, there is a documentary out. I think it's called Making Waves. And it's a documentary about the sound production process in film, you know, Foley and background noise and everything. And that's what I thought this was. So you can imagine my surprise when it starts playing, and that's not at all what this movie is about. It's about a high school wrestling star in Florida, and he seems to have it all. He's got a gorgeous girlfriend who's a cheerleader, and he's real fit, and he's popular, and he's on his way to getting a college scholarship. But then all these chips in the armor, all of these keystones in his life start to crumble. His girlfriend finds out she's pregnant. He discovers he has a long-standing injury that he's been ignoring. He has a bad relationship with his father because his father's kind of an a-hole and does not understand how to relate to his son. This happens a lot where the father's trying to vicariously live through the son's athletic achievements in high school, and all this stuff starts crashing down on him. That's what the first two-thirds of the movie is. The last third of the movie is the effect it has on his sister, who is in the background for most of the movie. This is done by the guy who did It Comes at Night and Krisha, which are fringe films that are at times very polarizing, especially It Comes at Night. Now, while this isn't a horror film, and it's a family dysfunction film in a way, but not in the way that Krisha, that one was more of a watch the uncomfortable things happen on one day. This is you're watching somebody's life fall apart. And it's interesting because it does put it in the perspective of you see people making stupid decisions and doing stupid things. And you sit there and it's easy to judge them from your ivory tower, even if your ivory tower is in the gutter itself. But what this movie does is it puts you in that person's seat, that puts you in that person's shoes and says, okay, I realize I wouldn't make the same decision this person's making, but I can see where the elements in this person's life push him to make that decision. And it shows the failure of the parents, and it shows the failure of his friends, and it shows the failure of him to just coherently talk to his girlfriend without freaking out because he's mimicking the behavior that his father has. Because, of course, his father is played by Sterling K. Brown, who does a pretty good job in this role, but his father's a real jerk. His father just decides to yell about everything, doesn't talk to him like he's a human being, and berates him all the time. And that doesn't de-escalate any of the problems that are happening in his life. It's not a fun movie to watch because you are watching people's lives implode in a lot of ways. And the girl who plays his sister is, she's actually quite good. I wanted to see a little bit more of her story, but she only got a small portion of it. And even then she shares it with another character. So you really don't get the emphasis on her. And she's not a bad little actress. She's the girl. She was in Escape Room earlier this year. I don't know. It's so funny because I still kind of think about this movie, and while I didn't love it, I thought it was an interesting character study into all these characters. I just wish they would have stuck with a character because they abandoned them so quickly, and there was a lot of really interesting depth to the story that I think at times never gets fully explored. But still, it's an interesting movie. It's not for everyone. It's a family drama, but it's worth checking out. So I'm going to say that Waves kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the Warrior Queen of Jhansi. This biopic follows the freedom fighter Rani of Jhansi, an Indian queen who fights against the British Empire in the 19th century.
The East India Company
is the greatest corporation in the history of the world.
And we will protect our interests.
Agreed.
She will never surrender. She needs to be broken and destroyed.
We will fight for what is ours. And we will win.
We have lost too many men.
Who said anything about men?
You really think you can train these women to fight like men?
No. I will train them to fight better than men.
This is apparently a true story. I don't know anything about it because I don't know much about the history of British colonialism or the history of India. I'm just some big fat guy from the Midwest, you know. I come from Columbus, Ohio, so I don't know the background here. I imagine if you're Indian or of Indian background or you've studied Indian history, or at the very least, if you've studied British colonial history, not colonial in America. That's what most Americans, if you say colonial British, you're thinking 1700s. No. The British were colonizing for 100 years after the American Revolution. And one of the big places they conquered was India. And one of the big things the British discovered, as they also discovered in Africa, is it's not so easy to run colonies. Colonialism is very, very difficult to do because you're not part of the culture and you don't understand the culture and you're mixing different people for different reasons and you're drawing other lines and it makes it very, very difficult. And you're always at that time, you're the oppressor and you're taking advantage of people. And this is, of course, about the East Indian Tea Company that was sort of like the front for and the reason for all of this expansionism and the control of resources. And this is about the Indians fighting back. Now, it went about as well as the American Indians fighting back against the white settlers, because you could be great with bows and arrows and spears, but when people are on horseback and have swords and cannons, you're at a disadvantage. And this movie, I think, would be most interesting to somebody who understands the history. It almost feels like the movie's approach is that you should be aware of the history. Be like making a movie about Joan of Arc. At least there's an awareness of who Joan of Arc is. I think most people in America have no idea who Ronnie of Jhansi is. And I didn't going in. And it sounds like a fascinating story, but in a way it feels like that Harriet Tubman movie they had a couple weeks ago, where I was like, Harriet Tubman deserved a much better movie than we got. Because the dialogue in this film is really corny and it falls flat and it feels like it's written for a TV movie. Also, strangely, the costuming, I don't know if this is a realistic depiction of Indians back in the 1850s, but of course you have the villagers who kind of dress and, you know, they still have it's cultural garbs, but it's just everyday robes and sashes and stuff. And every time the royalty's on screen, they're dressed to the nines and they got the jewelry on and everything. I mean, it looks like something that was done in The Phantom Menace, where Natalie Portman was in a different outfit every time. Some of the leaders are weirdly cast, and like one guy looks like he literally has a fake mustache on. It just kind of looks absurd and silly. And you don't feel like there's any sort of realness to the royalty angle, and you wonder where the separation is between royalty and the peasants, and they don't do a good job showing that at all. And the British are seen as almost these token bad guys and sort of mustache twirling bad guys. And then they have like these scenes with Queen Victoria, and they really undersell Queen Victoria's involvement in this. She's like, well, this is terrible. Why are we doing this? Shouldn't we stop? I'm like, you're queen. You could literally order people to stop right away. But I think it's such a girl power kind of movie, because right now that's the thing to do is girl power, rah, rah. It's such a girl power movie. It's almost like they don't want to make anything critical of Queen Victoria. They want her to make her as much of a victim in this, even though she wasn't, because she's freaking queen, for crying out loud. Anyways, The Warrior Queen of Jhansi, I wasn't terribly impressed with. I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about some more movies, Charlie's Angels and The Report. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews, and let's talk about Charlie's Angels. Elizabeth Banks directs this reboot of the American series about three beautiful spies who are searching for a weaponizable power source.
Outstanding angels.
You have a new client?
Who is she?
I'm the lead programmer on a product that can revolutionize the power industry, but there is a possibility it can be weaponized.
Elena, we need to go.
Who are you?
I'm Bosley.
Welcome to the Townsend Agency. We exist because traditional law enforcement can't keep up. Let's get the weapon before it becomes every bad guy's favorite new toy.
I was around when Charlie's Angels was on the air, and I know I swerved into it at least some points while I was channel surfing back in the 70s and 80s and the times it reruns, but I never really watched it with any sort of regularity. Back about 20 years ago, 19, 20 years ago, when they made the big budget movie version with McGee, and you know, you had Cameron Diaz and Drew Barrymore and Lucy Liu, I think I went back and watched a couple episodes, but I was never a huge fan of Charlie's Angels. It was never something I really gravitated towards. I was much more of a Dukes of Hazzard boy myself. But the Charlie's Angels concept, I think, was great, and I thought it really broke molds in the 70s. And by the time they did the movie in the year 2000, the idea of butt-kicking females on screen, we'd seen that before. I mean, the original Charlie's Angels was about 10 years after, you know, you had the Batman TV show where Batman and Robin weren't allowed to throw a punch at Catwoman. And fast forward to 1992, just 8 years before they made the Charlie's Angels movie, and that's when you had Michael Keaton as Batman beating the heck out of Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman. We had gotten past that, oh, don't hit the girl kind of, you know, if you're a superhero, you could still do that. And here, now we're in 2019, and the idea of a butt-kicking female is not new. That's the thing. And it wasn't new in 2000. They made it more of like an absurd, over-the-top, crazy version of that where they were going to make, it was just those were like fun movies. This one just, it comes off, it's literally the first scene. You have Kristen Stewart undercover, and she's like, well, most men, they underestimate women, and they don't see them as a threat, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, oh, my God, you're laying it on thick. It just, not only do we have movies around now with women as huge action stars, you know, Wonder Woman was a huge hit. You had Atomic Blonde last year. And even now, just this year, we've got movies with butt-kicking females. And I mean, people like Captain Marvel is one of the biggest movies of the year. So you can't tell me that there's this, oh, guys still don't think women can be formidable opponents. It's like, that's just putting words in somebody's mouth and building a straw man argument that doesn't even exist today. The movie itself, once you kind of get past the, at times, aggressively pushed girl power attitude of the movie, it's okay. It's a lark. It's a disposable story where they're chasing a MacGuffin. And the spies, it's nothing really serious. They're doing a kind of a whimsical spy movie. But here's the thing. You got the angels in themselves. You got Kristen Stewart as one of them. And I give her a lot of credit on this one because she does work outside of her normal framework. She is playing sort of the maverick, the crazy girl. And in the very first scene, she does her little twitchy things. But I think that was deliberate to then have her change her delivery into a much more of a rough and tumble character. And then you've got Naomi Scott, who is best known for being in the Aladdin remake. And then you got another girl I don't even recognize as the third angel. Apparently she's British and I don't know, she's been in stuff. But this is a big difference between Cameron Diaz, Drew Barrymore, and Lucy Liu, who all three were major stars at the time. You got Elizabeth Banks writing and directing, and she's not a great director. I respect the heck out of her for branching off into producing and stuff like that. She's doing the Pressure Luck TV show. That's great. But she's not a great director, because I thought Pitch Perfect was 2 was like, I don't know about that one. She's maybe a better writer. And she plays the new Bosley, and that's fine. But part of the problem is again, this movie just hammers away home this whole overly, you know, it's like that last scene in the Ghostbusters remake where Sigourney Weaver comes in and they're making the jokes and they're saying, don't be such a dude. Don't be scared. Don't be a dude. And I'm like, well, that's not what the phrase means. That means something culturally very different. The joke doesn't land. And it feels like this movie is pushing it so hard that it doesn't work. And the characters, it's not like wrapped around a big powerhouse cast. It's fun and it's a lark of a spy movie, but it's really not anything to write home about. So I'm gonna have to just say that Charlie's Angels kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Report. Adam Driver stars in this true story about the Senate investigation into the use of enhanced interrogation techniques and whether they amounted to torture.
Morning, Dan.
Morning, Senator.
Have you seen the story today in the New York Times?
Evidently, the CIA destroyed tapes of interrogations of Al-Qaeda detainees.
I want to find out what was on the tapes and why they were destroyed.
I vehemently disagree with the narrative here.
The United States does not torture.
Dan, you need to be careful here.
They can't destroy the documents. They can go after the next best thing, you.
What they really did was make it impossible to prosecute.
Here's one of those movies, and you get these every year, and it's right around award season. It reminds me a little bit of The Post, which came out a couple years ago. And that one was about the Supreme Court case over the Pentagon Papers. And it's very easy to approach these things from a partisan standpoint. It's very easy to approach The Post and say, well, you're just a bunch of liberal Democrats because it's got Steven Spielberg and you've got Meryl Streep playing this character and it's all anti-Nixon, this and that. But when you look back at it historically, the Pentagon Papers should have been released, and the Pentagon Papers were a black smear on American use of the military because it kept the military in there. Whether you were the Democrats or the Republicans, both sides were complicit in the bad things that happened in the Pentagon Papers. And you know what? The same thing is that way in the report. Yes, it comes at it from the perspective of the Democrats because it was Dianne Feinstein's office that was running this. And Annette Bening plays Dianne Feinstein, does actually a really good job. And yes, it was Dianne Feinstein's office that launched it, but it did try to be bipartisan. But then, of course, with shifting politics, you had shifting people in charge of the CIA and shifting people, even going from the presidency. And even at the time, they you can tell that they're frustrated with Obama's the way he's handling these things because he inherited these techniques. And so he's got to work on this and he still has to deal with stuff. So just showing everybody has dirty hands who was involved in this. And that's what I think is so fascinating about it. And one of the directives they give Adam Driver's character at the beginning of this movie when he starts this investigation is they're like, you got to look at it with the facts. You don't look at it as Democrat or Republican. And yes, you have the Democrats around him because it's that Democrat office of the senator that started this whole thing. But the facts of the case were not partisan at all. And you know, now I think we can all look back at this historically and say, whoa, this was not well put together from a cohesive standpoint at the beginning. This was not done the way America should be doing things. And they point out not just completely outside of partisan issues. There's a point in there where somebody says, look, you know, how do you expect if a soldier is captured and they quote the Geneva Convention, how are they going to be treated because their country's not treating other people the right way? And that's the real problem. And that's the problem with partisan political things that happen that are in the historical context. It doesn't matter whose side's doing it. If you're doing something wrong, it's bad because when the winds change, and they do, and you get the Democrats in charge or the Republicans in charge instead of the flip side, that party can use the exact same soiled tactics that you did. And that's one of the problems that this thing points out. And I think that does it in a great way by saying, look, if you're ferreting around for the truth, you're going to cheese off both sides. What's so crazy about this is it's based on a 7,000 page report. And I actually got sent by the production company the actual summary of the report, which itself is like 400 pages. And it's a massive document. And they made a movie that I found compelling and powerful, and I couldn't turn away. It was a fantastic movie. I suggest check it out. It's very informative and very intriguing. The report totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Ford versus Ferrari, The Good Liar, The Box Office, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Spirited Away. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. Actually, these are going to be previews because these are two movies I hadn't seen. There's so many movies coming out. I'm getting so many screeners and screenings, and my attention for movies is being spread all over the place. Unfortunately, they did not screen either of these locally for me. And I had so many other screenings to go see that I had to choose, and I couldn't see everything. And that's a shame because there's some good buzz surrounding both of these movies. The first one I want to talk about, just sort of as a preview, is Ford versus Ferrari. An engineer and a race car driver try to soup up a Ford to go head-to-head with the Ferrari in a speed test.
The iCoke Ford Motor.
Suppose Henry Ford II wanted to build the greatest race car the world's ever seen to win the 24 hours of Le Mans. What's it take?
Well, it takes something money can't buy.
Money can buy speed.
What in about speed?
You need a pure racer behind the wheel of your car. That's Ken Miles.
I don't trust him an inch.
You're gonna build a car to beat Ferrari with a Ford.
Correct.
I've been seeing ads for this for a while, and I got to admit, I was not sold on it when I first saw the trailers. I got to admit, I'm not a big race car fan. But, you know, stuff like Cars, I thought Cars 2, the whole Formula One racing against the stock car racing, I thought that was a fun little movie. I remember they had the movie Rush a couple years ago, which featured Chris Hemsworth in it. But apparently this is a very invigorating movie, and it looks great in the IMAX, and it's got great performances by Matt Damon, and more particularly Christian Bale. So yeah, you got Jason Bourne and Batman trying to win the speed race with a Ford instead of a Ferrari. And I mean, it's a classic story of American ingenuity going up against the Italian race car thing. And I hear it's got a lot of good buzz behind it, and it's a good solid movie. I'm sure I'll check it out in the next couple weeks, but right now I can't. But you know what? They didn't screen it for me, even though it's getting such great buzz. The heck with you guys. It gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with The Good Liar. A career con artist finds himself falling in love with his new mark.
Is that why you think you do it? For the money. It's the game. It's the adrenaline rush. What if it is?
How much do you think she's worth?
Millions.
I'm going to take it all.
Seems like you've had quite a past, Roy.
Enough to last several lifetimes.
You know, it's very peculiar. Doing things you'd never imagine.
This is another one that wasn't screened, and that's a shame because I love the people that are involved in it. You've got Ian McKellen and Helen Mirren in here, and Ian McKellen plays that con artist who's been around for decades and has been trying to go for a new mark, and he's brilliant at what he does, but maybe he's falling in love with her, or maybe she's marking him. I don't know. I love Helen Mirren, too. I think she's a international treasure, we'll say. And, you know, this looks like it might be a really intriguing movie. I'm wondering if it feels a little bit like a more serious version of something like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels or the remake of that, The Hustle, that came out this year. Another girl power movie that kind of flopped. Girl power, the necessity of girl power in a movie does not make a movie great. It's got to still be a good movie. But anyways, The Good Liar looks interesting enough. I personally am interested in seeing it. I'm sure I will check it out at some point. But, you know, like I said, right now, since they didn't screen it, I'm going to have to say that it gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office from last week. It was a huge upset last week. And there's two things happening that made this upset. Last Christmas, it didn't even make $12 million. And usually, you'd expect this time of year that kind of a movie would do well. I think there's two things working against Last Christmas from last weekend. The first is it's just way too early. If you look at it historically, there's oftentimes a movie that'll open right after Halloween because it's the beginning of November and they said, okay, let's make a Christmas movie. But those movies tend to not do terribly well. If you recall, the Nutcracker and the Four Realms was a little bit of a disappointment this last year. And like that when they did the Christmas Carol, the CGI mocap Christmas Carol with Jim Carrey, that one was kind of soft and that opened that first week of November. I don't think this is as strong of a holiday opening weekend. People, even if you open something like that before Thanksgiving, doing it the couple days after Halloween is just a little bit much. The other thing I think that's going against Last Christmas is there's already a bunch of Christmas movies on Hallmark and they're overplaying those already. Why do you need to go to the theater for that? And they've already announced that they're bringing out like 25 new ones this year that are going to be on the Hallmark channel. So if you want sappy Christmas romances, you don't even have to leave the house for that. Now, the other thing that happened to the box office is Midway came out ahead and won the box office with almost $18 million. I've heard a lot of people love this movie. I think it didn't hurt it opening on Veterans Day weekend, because that really played into it, because it, of course, honors the heroes of World War II. It overperformed, but it didn't overperform a lot. It just overperformed by a couple million. I think it was like 14 to 15 million was what they were projecting. And it made almost 18, which is good. But the big thing is that Dr. Sleep was supposed to make 25 million or more, and it just made barely over 14 million. That is not good at all. Dr. Sleep was a flop. It was a bona fide flop, and I'm surprised at how poorly it did with how popular The Shining has become in recent years. And I think, again, it's about release date. Just as this date was bad for Last Christmas because it was too early for a Christmas movie, this is a terrible release date for a horror movie a week after Halloween. If you want a Stephen King horror movie, open it in October or open it in September, because it certainly worked for It. Or hell, open it in August. Or February. January is a great time for horror movies, too. I just think that this dead zone of horror movies after Halloween, nobody wanted to see a horror movie right after Halloween, not in the mainstream at least. Anyways, everything else was pretty much expected. Terminator Dark Fate is dropping like a stone, only being preceded by Gemini Man falling even faster. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on Studio Ghibli's Spirited Away, which is getting a re-release and a special box set by Shout Factory. This thing's really nice, too. It's a nice, solid booklet. It's not one of those crappy steel books that bends the second you touch it. It's a nice, sturdy book. And the movie itself is a great movie. Let's talk about that first, really quickly. Hayao Miyazaki directs this Oscar-winning animated film about a girl who wanders into a spiritual dimension on her way to her new home in the country.
Come on, let's go in. I want to see what's on the other side.
Where are you going? Hey! You said just a quick look!
Don't be afraid. I'm Master Haku.
No!
I just want to help you.
No!
Witch Ibaba controls you by stealing your name. If you completely forget it, you'll never find your way home.
Your name belongs to me now.
I want you to know my real name. It's Chihiro.
This movie is done by Studio Ghibli. It's directed by Hayao Miyazaki, who's done movies like My Neighbor Totoro and Nausicaa, the Valley of Wind, and of course later movies like Howl's Moving Castle. And his stuff's very fantasy oriented. This one has an energy at the beginning that some of his other films don't, that I think really jazzed international audiences. It's steeped in Japanese lore and mythology and imagery, but you don't need to understand that to still have a fascination with the movie. It's the story of a girl just trying to get home and meeting some of the most insane creatures that you're ever going to meet. And it has these fantastical elements that happen. Very hard to explain, but it's totally worth seeing. It's sweet and it's tender. It's beautifully animated and it has character designs that are out of the box. If it's one that I hadn't seen. I'd seen like Totoro and Howl's Moving Castle and all that kind of thing, but I'd never seen Spirited Away. I'm so glad I had a chance to see it. And the new Blu-ray comes with, it's not loaded with special features, but it has some really, really nice, slick ones on there. It includes a CD of the soundtrack, if you still have a CD player. But that's a beautiful soundtrack that it has. It has a 40-page booklet that comes with it that looks at the art and the development and the design of the film. It has feature-length storyboards and a behind-the-microphone look at the voice cast, obviously, the English voice cast, and, of course, the original TV trailers and theatrical trailers. Usually, the behind-the-scenes featurettes, a lot of them for like something like a Studio Ghibli piece, are in Japanese, so you don't have those. And that's okay, because this is a nice box set to get in your collection at home. It's worth having. It's a movie you can watch with the kids or watch it as an adult and enjoy it. I'm going to say Spirited Away and the box set edition from GK Kids and Shout Factory totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And that is it for the week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Frozen 2, Dark Waters, and A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.